Thus, you must realize that you have no idea before you can know the idea. We scan across all the frequencies if we want to learn anything new. Let us begin.
What has physics done for me lately?
Furthermore, the equation E is equal mc squared.
We have now acquired a fateful power to alter and to destroy nature.
That's like when you're in physics and you get a dream about saying, oh, this is a physics excursion.
Science. What is it all about?
The whole of human history all falls in the dust of one stroke of the nail file. You can't really get to grips with evolution unless you realize what an enormous amount of time.
Our own planet is only a tiny part of the vast cosmic tapestry, a starry fabric of worlds yet untold.
You're tuned in to what can only be described as the best radio station on this blue dot we call Earth. It is, of course, for Triple Z. Beat it on your conventional wireless radio by tuning into the classic frequency, 102.1 FM, digital devices such as DAB or smart speaker, listening via the Community Radio Plus app, or streaming us live from our sensational website at 4ZZZ.org.au. And of course, you can always listen back to us or any 4ZZZ show for that matter using the ingenious on-demand feature also found at that URL. We also now have a weekly podcast of the show, which Gabe prefers. Just search for our show name, which is, of course, no idea, spelt with a K. Your weekly dose of the science. And joining me today to speak all things science are some of my favourite science communicators. Two of them may be outside the studio as we speak. Good morning, Izzy. Good morning, V.
On time, was that what the message we got this morning?
I'm definitely on time. That was the message.
And the Masters. Good morning, Peter. And good morning, Gabe.
Max. Morning, Max. Now, Max, I've got a question for you. Can you give this a listen?
What's going on here?
Bit of AI.
Do you need to be left alone?
What? No. Where did that music make you feel?
Oh.
Do you want to hear it again?
Yeah. I felt like... Yeah, go on. Do it again. Yes.
Makes me feel like I'm in beginner music.
Like
not how. Where? Where on your body can you feel that sound?
Oh.
Because some new research has found that different musical chord progressions trigger feeling in different parts of our physical body.
Yeah.
You can send us a text if you want to.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I read
send
the
us
article.
Text. What's our number, Max? 0420626733.
Job done.
Boom. You can find it on the website if you need it. And I'll get into how that works and which chords do what in a minute. We've also got some stuff on a touch robot built for schools, some new disc satellites. Yep.
I know.
That's Max's
science
coming out next.
I'm a bit worried about that robot.
Peter says she needs to talk about, quote, a worm with really big eyes in her friendly neighborhood marine science segment.
You just like took, you're not even going to, do. Usually when I tell you, you're like, what is your story? I tell you, then you act me funny about it. You're just saying.
A worm with really big eyes. I wrote it down.
Wonderful.
We just got a text in from Quentin. Yes, we received it. All it reads is the letter Q. Job done. Oh, here we go. Hey, Max, how long would it take for your voice to reach Pluto? Well, we'll wait for the space news and we'll work that out for you, Quentin.
He's doing the maths in between now. Though.
Yeah, yeah. Punch some numbers.
And someone's trying to ring me. Stop ringing me. I can't talk to you while I'm on the air. So, but subscribe. Please subscribe. Okay. Who wants to go first?
I'll go first.
Thanks, Peter.
It seems like we need a little bit of quiet right now, and that's what my story is about.
Mm.
Every so often, a group of engineers or physicists will find out something about the ocean that is just fantastic. And last week, engineers at Johns Hopkins University, QS ranking...
Johns Hopkins?
Yeah.
120.
It's 28.
Oh.
You So these engineers found out that fish are actually quieter as a group. We know that fish primarily school because it provides some level of protection against predators. Like visually, they're also harder to catch, you know, etc. Just being in a group generally pretty decent. That's why we have herding animals on land. But this team wanted to know if it helped them be any quieter. Mainly because they want to make boats and things, because they're engineers. They don't actually, you know, it's not for the love of the game, but that's fine.
So it's not the physicists this time, it's the engineers.
I know, yeah.
Physicists doing schooling science last week.
It was.
And the engineers this week.
I know. We've been having a lot of other people meddling, which is fine.
Week, the chemistry of schooling fish.
That's right.
That'd be funny. So they did the obvious thing to figure this out, and they created an incredibly complex 3D model of mackerel to simulate them swimming in different formations with different numbers of fish and changing up exactly how synced they were with each other. And I do actually think this is a good methodology, because if you can't really just go up to fish in the wild and record them, because there are so many other different variables with that, like what type of fish, how are they swimming, where are they swimming. So I think the model kind of works. But what they found is that if a school of fish swam together in just the right way, they were actually stunningly effective in reducing their noise. In fact, a school of 7 fish sounded like just 1 fish. And given that sound is incredibly important in the ocean, this could actually be super important to prey fish. And despite what your initial thoughts may be, it's not that they swim in exactly the same way. It's actually that, you know, if they swam in unison with their tail fins flapping at the same time, the sound would actually add up. But when they alternate their tail flaps, they're able to cancel out each other's sound. And this is really essentially basic wave science. So if you remember your sine waves curves from school, they go above the line and below the line. If your red curve is peaking above the line at the same time as your blue curve is, then the wave that comes out of that is double the height because they add to each other. Whereas if your red curve is at its peak and your blue curve is at its trough, they cancel each other out and the result is flat. And it's exactly the same for sound. Sound is a wave. The amplitude or height of the wave is roughly equivalent to volume or how loud something is. So if you can reduce this amplitude by flapping your tail fins in opposite directions, you can actually be quieter. And weirdly, they kind of just threw this in at the end. The model also apparently showed that this quieter method of swimming allowed the fish to move faster with less energy as well. Which is always a bonus.
Because there'd be less disturbance.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Through the water.
The same thing.
Yeah, fluid dynamics.
That energy.
Yeah.
Really, really basic wave science. But I thought that was really interesting. I'd love to see if they could get this in the wild with real fish, not computer fish. Because who knows if they can.
See if you can figure out how many fish there are based on the noise level.
And then we might get marine scientists involved.
Then maybe, yes. We only like it when there's real water involved. That's where my line is.
Okay, what do you got?
Oh, Max, I got for you the sound. Now, I gave you a crack, Peter and Max, before, but Izzy and V, where does this music make you feel? Anything?
Angry.
Do you get any physical sensations anywhere in your body?
Not really.
My ears.
Nothing? Your ears?
I can hear it. Gabriel, that's where it comes in my ears.
The back
ears.
Of your where?
The back of my head or like my neck?
Yeah, I was going to say neck because it's kind of groovy. So you're kind of moving,
Can I give you another one?
Sure.
If you must.
Anything?
I think my knees, but that's probably because I was moving them.
Gave the shoulders a little shimmy, so maybe they're...
Little shoulder shimmy. Like, and this one, I'll give you one more just because this is for Izzy. This was their 69th track that they did.
Nice!
Now, I'm asking you about where you feel... Yeah, go, Max.
Is that AI producing that, or is it just a really bad pianist?
I think it's just, like, garage band style stuff.
Really it sounds like something you'd hear like on, like, Sibelius. A lo-fi hip-hop playlist. Yeah.
But I'm asking about where you feel these different bits of music for a reason, and that reason comes to us from researchers out of the University of Tokyo.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. We did this recently.
They're pretty low, aren't they? They're, like, 30.
Now, I reckon I'll pick up this up.
QS ranking?
Because I've written 28...
That's
just what you just said.
They're not 28. That's definitely not it. That's John Hopkins.
20-something, I reckon.
I'll look it up. 22.
Those reasons.
Nice.
It. Maybe it's a what shared it ranking.
Luckily, everything's peer reviewed on this show, so
peer bullied.
23.
University of Tokyo. Okay, wow, cool. I did them dirty. Mm. Those researchers wanted to know, what is it about music that makes us physically feel music in our bodies? And specifically, they wanted to know what chords give us sensations in our hearts and in our stomachs. To do that, they played...
Sorry.
Yep.
They went into this being like, yes, when I listen to jazz, my stomach goes alive.
Yeah, I think they just sort of maybe had some like some pre-study work done where they'd found people talking about feeling it in their guts or something. I don't know.
Are they sure this isn't a type of synesthesia?
It could be. But to do that, they played 92 unique chord progressions, like the ones you heard and like this one. They're all pretty similar. But they designed them all to have different levels of like certainty and surprise within them to see if that changed how you feel. Okay. I know, weird, right? And they put these in front of 500 people and those 500 people had a body outlined on a screen in front of them. After listening to the chords, they had to click where on the body that bit of music made them feel. And the data showed that certain chord progressions spark sensations in the heart while others were felt more in the stomachs. Now, I've got
No, this sounds like one of those psych studies you get pulled up for when you're studying psych at uni and you just click through. You're just like, I need to get out of
like
here.
A mandatory credit.
And the researchers already know the result. Yeah.
I'm sorry.
We're just poking holes
in Kate's story.
I apologize to the University of Tokyo, but wow.
Curious ranking.
Now, that first one I played you, number one. This is apparently the one that got the most feel in the heart.
Yeah, I could say that.
Well, after you've heard it, yeah, of course.
I've been conditioned.
Let's do a double-blind experiment there, Max. Come on.
And this one, Max, right, yes, is the one that you feel most in your abdomen.
Yeah, I could hear that too. I know.
See, Max is on with it.
He's just saying he can hear. You're literally telling him, hey, do you feel this in your abdomen? And all of a sudden you're super aware.
This is a pushing ball and I'm proud of it.
I'm against this study. I'm putting my flag in the sand. I'm against this study.
Okay.
They say that more predictable chord progressions brought on feelings of calmness, relief, satisfaction, nostalgia, empathy, and based on the findings, They're keen to continue studying how different bits of music make us feel in different parts of our body, and they're also keen to see how just use these sort of studies to look into links between different types of music and mental health.
I do have a fun story that's related to this that my music teacher once told me. So, like you mentioned, there are actually known chords called like perfect chords and perfect. Oh, goodness, I've gotten the name now. Sorry, Miss Kelly. Essentially, there are like progressions that your body just, for some reason, we just like more. It just sounds better. I think the physics behind it is that the waves have similar phases. So like the sound waves sort of sync up better. But regardless of that, there are just known chord progressions that make us go, ah. And there's this famous story that apparently Mozart's mum used to get him out of bed in the morning by going down to the piano, playing a chord progression and not doing the perfect finish.
Yes.
Go downstairs and play it to like
such
ease
a
that's
brain.
His alarm. Nice.
Yeah, okay. I would do that. That makes perfect sense. But yeah, that was my funny story. Thank you, Miss Kelly.
We'll play a song and we'll come back for my weird science. And for those wondering what my weird science, if you want to get onto YouTube and type in touch IBO tree.
What is that? That looks like something you'd find on a sketchy website.
Yeah, I know.
We'll find out all that and more after this.
Hey, 4ZZZ listener, April Atoman is here again, marking another year of supporting the station we love. If you haven't subscribed yet, but dig what you're hearing, why not take the plunge and subscribe? You'll go into the draw to win a prize and get a fresh hit of warm inner glow from keeping us on air. So let's keep the party going. Head on over to 4ZZZ.org.au to subscribe today.
So my research comes from a team from the University of Lisbon, QS ranking.
Lisbon.
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 Not Brisbane.
200 Lisbon.
With an L, yeah.
like an alternative.
210.
2, 6, and another 6.
Ooh. Ooh.
And you did Cornell University last week, Gabe, so you should know this one.
Yeah, Gabe.
QS ranking?
18.
Close. It's a baker's dozen. 13. Has presented a touch-based robot that is capable of fostering inclusion in schools. Their recent study showed improved individual and group participation perception. The robot...
No, this doesn't sound good. I don't like this. Did you make new friends at school today? Yeah, mommy, the robot loves me. Oh, my God.
The robot they use is called Touchibo, which has been developed to improve group interactions between children with and without visual impairment, simply using the power of touch. One of the researchers, Isabella Nieto, explains, Touchibo aims to bridge the gap between children with diverse visual needs, prompting participation, empathy, and social engagement. The study involved 107 children, including 37 with visual impairments, who participated in a series of storytelling activities facilitated by Touchibo, and an audio-only story was told. Researchers analysed the children's responses, touch behaviours, and group dynamics to evaluate the impact of touch-based interactions on social engagement and inclusion. Children who engaged with Touchibo are forever scarred, exhibited a significantly increased perception of individual and group engagement compared to the interactions with the audio-only storyteller. Touchibo not only promoted touch-based interactions between children, but also enhanced the children's perception of the storyteller's likability and helpfulness, highlighting the robot's potential to enrich social interactions in classrooms with children with mixed visual abilities. The researchers are trying
I'm still confused. What's the robot actually doing?
You touch it. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't talk or anything.
So like a teddy bear?
But it's very tactile. Like if you go onto the YouTube thing, it sort of has little plastic fingers that come out and touch you and retract.
Oh, that's creepy. Ah, what the hell?
Hey, kids, it's time to play with the touching robot now.
Has anyone cleaned it yet? Or?
No more quiet reading. It's time to play with its tentacles.
Human interaction is gone. Touchibo is here. Yeah.
It's a very spooky looking thing anyway. Anyway, so the study was presented last month and published as part of the proceedings of the 2024 International Conference of Human-Robot Interaction. Done. Izzy,
that something we need to develop? Like, are we just getting ready for AI to take over the world? What's happening? Like, is it better for the robot or for us? Like, I don't know if I would be like, hey, Bobby, go to school, get ready to touch the robot. Like, I just don't know if that's a key part of human development. I don't understand. I think I need the researcher to tell me exactly how this is better than just getting children to have healthy relationships with one another.
It's almost like they built the robot first and then said, now what are we going to use it for, type thing. And
almost. So,
and then let's justify this with a science experiment.
Cool.
Yeah.
It sort of looks like something that came out of the...
It's like Bop It.
Yes! Exactly what I was about to say. It came out of the, innovation department at Bop It.
Oh, God, they just play
sponsored by it, Hasbro?
It should be. What do you got for us, Izzy?
All right. Class is in for lizards, and the first rule is get that out of your mouth.
We're talking about touchy bow again.
We're not talking about... Jesus. No. From the from Macquarie University, I did not get the QS ranking, I'm sorry. There is a landmark study published in the journal Conservation Letters, which outlined a new strategy to help vulnerable native species against our resident invasive cane toads. Mm. Led by Dr. Georgia... Yeah, exactly. Led by Dr. Georgia Ward-Fear, who is a postdoctoral research fellow at Macquarie University, showed that there are higher survival rates in groups of goannas in the remote Kimberley area of Western Australia.
Pause. Yeah. Pause. Pause. Say it again.
Goannas.
Goannas.
Yeah. Goannas.
Goannas.
I'll get Jay in and he can help me out with my pronunciation.
Goannas.
Goannas. What is it again?
Goannas.
Goannas. Yeah. Sorry.
Goanna.
Goanna. Yeah. Anyway, in the remote Kimberley area of Western Australia, who was trained to avoid poisonous cane toads, Dr. Ward Fear and other research fellows did smaller field trips in 2016 where they found that when lizards were exposed to younger, smaller cane toads, they did get sick from consuming them, but it was not fatal. They found that lizards were more likely then to avoid cane toads after that. So that's just kind of learnt experience,
it's
you
like
know.
Vaccines.
Yeah, exactly. So they all get a little bit sick, therefore I'm probably not going to eat the thing that got me sick again. Natural evolution.
It's not like a vaccine.
Oh, it's not like a vaccine. It's behavior.
Learned behavior.
Yeah.
Like when you eat bad seafood as a child.
I was about to say, right. You're eating the vaccine. Anyway.
Yeah. I would way prefer to, if someone could make that. Anyway.
Coming back to this new science, Macquarie University researchers hosted a, quote, conditioned taste aversion teaching on a group of yellow-spotted monitors a tropical goanna species heavily impacted by cane toad spread. There you go. The team taste trained individual goannas in the field, tracking them with radio tags for the arrival of a highly poisonous adult cane toads heading to the invasive front line. So they helped these guys, they taught them taste training and then just released a bunch of adult cane toads into their population and just said, go buck wild.
Because that's never gone horrible.
But the taste-drained goannas obviously had better survival rates. So at the controlled sites that did not introduce the smaller taster toads before the larger, highly poisonous adult cane toads arrived, their populations dropped by about 94%.
Holy crap.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That's a mental image to think about.
Yeah.
But this is one of many studies that is happening in a team called the Cane Toad Coalition, which is to help native species obviously build resilience against, well, cane toads. So that's my weird
so
science.
Cool. So cool. So cool. It's like, it's pretty crazy to think about how much they would have had to jump through to deliberately introduce cane toads anywhere.
Yeah. That's what I'm They're like, just trust me. On. Just yeah. trust me, bro.
Trust me, bro. But
trust me, bro. I think okay. it's gonna work. We're just gonna, you know.
No, hear me out. Mm-hmm. I also hate them. But what if we put them somewhere where they're not? You know, just hear me out.
It's so cool, though. Like, there's so many stories of the cane toad front, which is just gradually moving across the country.
Yep.
Reaching a new area, and the scientists will sit there, they'll do a survey of lizards before, during, after, and you just watch, like you said, was it like 94% of lizards that are big enough to eat a cane toad are just gone.
Yeah.
They're dead.
It's crazy.
And there's no... And it just sort of stays like that forever after that point.
Yeah.
We have a high lizard extinction rate in this country as well.
Yeah, and they're being wiped out. You just see this... They just get wiped out when the cane toads reach there.
Yeah.
So this learning thing, I think it was first done in the Northern Territory with quolls,
mm-hmm.
where they had some problems, and they brought maybe Northern Territory, maybe Northern Queensland, and they would like capture mother quolls and feed them small bits of cane toads. So this one's just gone with small cane toads, but they would feed them small pieces. And so they got a bit sick of the smell.
Mm-hmm.
And then they learned that the mothers would teach the offspring, and so they like were trying to breed the behavior of avoiding cane toads into just quolls. But if they can do it with like all lizards, just by introducing some baby ones before, that would be pretty damn cool.
Yeah, because wasn't there that really famous story about like cane toad sausages and things like that, where they would use basically cane toad meat and introduce it in that kind of way, so they got used to kind of the taste, the smell, etc.
Yeah,
but I'm really excited to kind of see where this goes, especially when this is part of like a larger, broader scheme of things to help native species. But yeah, I was so surprised to see it was in Western Australia, because we're kind of renowned in Queensland for our cane toads.
Mm.
So oh, yeah, to know that it's moving across the front, kind of terrifying, yeah, very terrifying.
Yeah, I feel bad for WA. Sorry about that.
Imagine a future where we're just airdropping cane toad sausages and baby cane toads at the front to get the lizards ready.
When did we start calling this the cane toad? You know how we had the emu war?
The cane toad war?
Yeah, true. We should do that.
I don't know if we'll win this one either, though, to be fair.
Yeah, pretty good fight.
They do. They're so solid. Anyway.
And we had a text in on My Weird Science about Touchy Bo, and DJ Oz wants to know if Touchy Bo actually has a blue card or not. So.
Ew.
That's a good question.
Ew.
We're going to listen to 4ZZZ.
Yeah.
It's 10:37. It's No Idea. Your weekly dose of science and creepy robots.
Yeah. Gabe has a lot of penis facts in his brain, just generally.
That's going to be another little...
another sting for the
That's
show.
A sting for the show. There we go.
All right. Now, the good thing is we may not have Max, we may not have Gabe, but we do have penis facts.
Triple Z.
We want to appeal to your senses.
You tune into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max, V, Izzy, Gabe, and our friendly neighbourhood marine scientists. What do you got for us, Peter?
So, I don't know if any of you remember Anders Gum? Question mark?
No.
No?
No, I don't think so.
Is that an arcade game?
Well, I do. Because a couple of weeks ago, I told you about some research that he did on jellyfish and how they're apparently much smarter than we think. And he charmed me because Anders Gum, a neuroscientist, was the one to get all interested in figuring it out, despite the fact that, you know, jellyfish don't have brains. And my man, Anders, has found a new contrary species to keep him busy, and it's the vanity bristleworm. Because despite being almost completely transparent and spending most of their active time at night, the vanity has humongous eyes, like 20 times the weight of the rest of their heads.
Whoa.
Like, I cannot explain how huge their eyes are. Yeah, what are you seeing? It's like it's got two red balloons taped to the end of its body. And it's really, Gabe's jaw just dropped when he Googled it because it's genuinely crazy. And it's hard to explain how massive the eyes are. If our eyes were as big proportionally, we would need a sturdy wheelbarrow and some extra hours at the gym because we'd have to lug around an extra 100 kilograms. Like, and that would look horrific on us, but I also want to stress just how horrific it looks on this worm. Like, they're really, really, really ugly, which is kind of why I think it's hilarious that their name is another name for Venus, the Roman goddess of love. I need someone to explain why they call it that, because I just cannot figure it out. Anyway, Anders and some mates at the University of Copenhagen, QS ranking...
57.
I was going to go 58.
Okay.
We talked about this a few weeks ago.
65.
82.
Oh,
83.
Nice.
Let's go.
Very nice. Very nice. It's 82.
I think we should just standardize this and just call them all 69 and just leave it at that.
Yeah. The challenge is exciting.
That would kill the game. So these guys went about figuring out why something that, as far as we know, is only active at night and is otherwise transparent would develop such large visible eyes. To put it simply, what is just so important that they are trying to see? Because the thing about eyes is they can't be transparent. They have to be, because, you know, the way that light works. So why would you give up being able to be completely transparent for something so visible like these massive eyes? Like, they're just giant red things on something that is otherwise invisible. So what is the point? Why have you given up so
much? What is evolution saying to us here? Yes.
Yes, exactly.
Tell us evolution. What is it, Peter?
What is evolution?
No, sorry. Why have they evolved? Sorry, why have they evolved this way?
Well, keep listening and I will tell you. The first thing we need to decipher is whether their eyes actually have good eyesight, right? Because you can have big eyes that don't work very well theoretically. So they actually had to test whether they work. And they found out they do have, quote, excellent and advanced eyesight. So everyone a little clap for these worms. Woo! Very well done. They found out that they can see small objects and track their movements, which is apparently a skill usually reserved for vertebrates like us, as well as arthropods like spiders and cephalopods like octopuses. So that's really the only small groups that are kind of doing this. So very good for this worm. Apparently it has eyesight on par with mice and rats, which is incredibly impressive for its minuscule brain. Like, I cannot imagine that its brain is doing much more than just seeing at this point in time. So the good thing is it can see really well, but as far as we know, all of its important activities only occur at night, where, as we all know, it's very hard to see. So why would you even do this if you're spending most of your time huddled away somewhere dark and then you do stuff in the nighttime? Well, this is where Anders and his team have a bit of a theory. They think that part of the explanation may be due to the fact that these worms are actually seeing a different wavelength than we normally do, because their vision is geared towards ultraviolet light. Now, ultraviolet light, again, like all other forms of light, comes during the daytime from the sun. But what they think might actually be happening is that these eyes are geared to see specific bioluminescent signals in the otherwise pitch black water.
Marsupials.
And this... What?
Huh?
I mean, yeah, some marsupials are, but, like, we're going to skip right over that.
Anyway.
So, essentially, they think it could be to see the signals of other creatures, maybe, but they actually think what it might be more towards is that they think the worms themselves are bioluminescent and communicate with each other via the light. Because if you use normal bioluminescence, like the blue and green stuff that we can see, which is in the normal spectrum of light, or our spectrum of light, you would be very open to predators. But if you developed the ability to be bioluminescent on the UV scale, and then you developed eyes to be able to see in UV, you would essentially have your own secret language. Like, do you guys remember those diaries we used to have as kids, and they had the UV ink, and then you'd, like, put the light on it, it's like a secret diary? It's like that in their skin. So, pretty cool. But it's just a theory at this point. I mean, we've got our man Anders Garm onto it, so I know he's going to figure it out. I have all of my faith in Anders. But in the meantime, it is actually still really interesting, because the further research on this little worm's peepers is actually helping us to understand eyes better as a whole. Because, as we've mentioned before, there's this large sort of historical debate that dates back to Darwin as to whether eyes developed just once or many times. And given that these worms only picked up eyes over the past few million years, which is really quite young, it's another example of the growing list that proves that eyes have probably evolved multiple, multiple times and into the same sort of functionality, which is really interesting.
That's amazing. Yeah. That is so cool.
There's lots of cool things to see. Yeah. I told you this worm would be cool. Just saying it's a big-eyed worm is doing him dirty.
if you want to see a photo, it's up on the 4ZZZ.org.au website. Just look for No Idea. It's a weird-looking thing. Looks like egg yolk sort of attached to the...
Yeah, he's got lots of things to see.
He's got big peepers.
Probably.
I think it's quite cute.
Probably. You think?
I think so.
I mean, usually things with bigger eyes we perceive as cuter. That's why babies have big eyes compared to their heads. Same with puppies.
Mm.
Don't know if you knew that. That's a thing.
Or is it the other way around? Do we like big eyes because babies have big eyes?
I mean, that could be a thing. But then there's a definite thing where domestic dogs have bigger eyes when they're younger. And also, I think they just have bigger eyes in general compared to the size of their heads, which makes us as humans go like, oh, baby, I must look after it.
So we'll domesticate this worm and make its eyes even bigger.
Yes!
Okay, here's the situation. We've been on air for almost 50 years now, and it's because of the support from chillers like you.
Getting out there and spreading the word, subscribing yourself, your pets, your bands and your friends.
And tuning in.
But we can't keep the party going without you.
So this April Atonement, go ahead and renew your subscription for another year.
Still not convinced? To sweeten the deal, we've got some prizes on offer that we think you'll love.
If you're choosing a concession, full, passionate or super subscription, you can choose from
a New Farm Cinemas Retro Screenings Gold Card,
a Big Fork Theatre Gold Card,
Felons Brewing Co. Experience,
Brisbane Festival VIP River Fire Package,
a Jets Fortitude Valley Membership,
and tattoos from Oracle Tattoo Artists El Mulls, Trang St. Mars, Woven Bones Tattoo, Tattoos by Tammy G, Pearl Blonde Flicks, Merce Tattoos, SD Carroll, and So Heavy Tattoo. Head to 4zzz.org.au to subscribe and kick back with us this April Atonement.
You tune into 4ZZZ and the show is No Idea with me, Max, V, Izzy, Peter and Gabe. And we thought we'd take this opportunity to say you should subscribe because it is April Atonement. So you go into the running for some fabulous prizes as well as subscribing and getting that warm inner glow. Gabe, what do you reckon?
I reckon I've got the Felons Brewing prize pulled up today and I reckon that's the one. I think that's going to be my winner.
Yeah. How are you going to do that, though?
Well, I might have to resubscribe, but we'll see how we go.
You've just got to decide that you're getting the prize. I think that's called inside trading.
If you subscribe, you get to pick one of a bunch of prizes that are up for grabs April. Mm. This one from Felons Brewing and Felons Barrel Hall is a behind-the-scenes brewery
tour. Oh, it's a co-experience.
And tasting.
Okay.
And yeah. And then you get go to join a party with a lineup of a bunch of acts as well on the 16th of June. Pretty good.
Nice.
Pretty damn good.
You can subscribe for as little as $20 for your pet. You can then, if you're under 18, it's $20. If you're... How do you say go in again?
Shut up.
Concession is $35. A full is $70, a passionate $130, and if you want to be a super sub like Bones, it's $500, and you get your name written down on the wall downstairs forever and eternity. For as long as 4ZZZ, how long have we been going for? Almost 50 years.
Since 1975.
Nice.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So just go on to
the... Stunning. Right off the mark.
Go off the website, 4ZZZ.org.au/support, and subscribe for any amount you wish. We don't actually check, so don't worry. You can do whatever you want.
Mm-hmm.
And you go into the running for the April Atonement Prizes for the month of April, obviously. So try and do it before the end of the month. How many days in this month? 30?
Yes, so.
I think so.
30 days.
Yeah. Nice. Yeah.
I don't know, song. To be honest. Yeah, well, I have to do the song every single time because right. I never remember.
That's right. Or you can phone downstairs. I'm pretty sure Steve would be down there. It's 07-3252-1555, and he can take your subscription for you as well. And Liz Witt should be there this afternoon as well, who did the artwork for this April Atonement. So that's pretty cool.
Very cool. Check it out
on the website. Any more to add, anyone, about subscribing? Just do it.
I reckon just check it out. If you haven't subscribed to 4ZZZ before, because we know most of the people who listen to radio and podcasts and things don't subscribe, but check it out this year and just have a look at the April Atonement website and see what's up there. Have a look and see if you can support 4ZZZ and go into the running to win a prize or
so. You never know how good that woman in a glow is going to feel until you try it out.
Exactly.
So, we've been on air now for almost 50 years, and it's because of the support from chillers like you.
Getting out there and spreading the word, subscribing yourself, your pets, your bands and your friends, and tuning in.
But we can't keep the party going without you, so this April Atonement, go ahead and renew your subscription for another year.
To sweeten the deal, we've got some prizes on offer that we think you'll love.
For band and solo artist subscribers, you'll go in the draw to win venue hire and a photo shoot at Ventspace.
If you're under 18, you can win an electric guitar pack from Woods Music.
Got a business or a community organisation? Subscribe them and you could win a micro gallery from Art from the Margins.
Or subscribe your whole household for a chance to win a music and merch pack from us and 4,000 records.
To subscribe and view the full prize list, head to 4ZZZ.org.au.
Okay, it's time for the best part of the show. Loosely defined as science, yeah, you already know. Everybody listens to 4ZZZ just to hear us talking about what Butters just did. Subscriptions just keep rolling like the tires on a car. But something tells me that our science careers won't go far. But unlike an engine, I won't keep you in suspension. We're all here to hear him talk, so let's give him attention. You're not ready for when he starts rapping. Gonna hand the mic to Max and I'm not talking Van Stappen.
It's lights out and away we go.
I thought I'd kick it off with some NASCAR, especially the feeder series called Xfinity. And this is where ex-supercar champion SVG, Gabe, you want to tell them who that is?
Shane Van Gisbergen, as the American commentators like to call him.
And
New Zealander, about to say Aussie, in the supercars here, the classic Aussie race series.
V8s, yeah.
Jumped over to the... NASCAR race over in the US for some street stuff this year.
Yes, because he wants to race in NASCAR because they get to race basically 52 weeks a year, where in Australia you do it once a month in supercars. So he felt that his abilities were being sort of not used to their full capacity. So he has to sort of get his oval license. And to get his oval license, he has to go in the feeder series called Xfinity. And the cars aren't as powerful as the cup cars. Mm. But any road race where the cup cars are racing, he's allowed to enter those. So, the classic one was, what was it? The Chicago one, where he, on debut, actually won the street race around the streets of Chicago.
It feels a bit off, right? Mm. Like this guy is racing street circuits in NASCAR, has been racing all sorts of circuits here.
Yes.
And now he has to get his license to drive in a circle.
In a circle, yeah, I know.
It feels a bit like going from your opens to your P's, doesn't it?
So one of the toughest circles or oval tracks in the US is called Martinsville. And SVG came home 11th on the weekend. And he received a bit of bump and run, they call it. A bit of bump. Oh, we got a subscriber.
Whoa.
Hey.
Hit it.
Thanks, Kev from Thornside. And the
loves the SVG chat.
That's right. And he sort of learned what you have to do. You have to go on the inside running for that. We've got another subscriber.
Again?
What is going on?
Oh my goodness.
And the so he got pushed out into the outer circuit, but he learned from his mistakes and he made sure he was down the bottom of the run, and he managed to get home in 11th, which was pretty good. So we'll see him racing full time in the Cup Series in 2025. Okay, the big one. It's my birthday. It's Sunday. And there's also a Formula One race. And it was in Japan. Who wants to talk about that? Did you watch it, Gabe?
I did. I did indeed. It was... I got to be honest with you. I watched it on replay later that night. And I did fall asleep at about lap 30 or 50.
That's right. That's your honest assessment.
I honestly fell asleep at about 32 laps in and went back and watched the rest and didn't miss much.
No.
But... Yeah, look, it had some moments. The chief one, I think you'll get to, Max, being what happened on the opening few corners.
Yes, the third corner of the first lap. Mm. Everyone's favourite driver, Daniel Ricciardo, clipped, Albon driving the Williams?
No, other way around. Albon clipped him.
Oh, okay. Do you think so?
Well, I mean, look, they put it down to being a racing incident, but at the end of the day, Albon's the car behind.
Hmm.
And Ricardo's turning in. He's trying to avoid Stroll, which makes this even funnier. Like, Ricardo's just paranoid about Stroll.
Yes.
So he takes a weird line into turn three, and
I think this
Albon, I don't think, was ready for it.
There's two drivers you've got to be worried about on the grid, isn't it? It's George Russell and Stroll.
Are the two I'd ones. Add K-Mag to that as
K-Mag?
Well.
Yeah. Just got to be give them plenty of racing room because they're going to hit you. Anyway, so that meant that his Red Bull... Visa Red Bull got knocked out, and also Albon. And how's all the chassis for Williams going at the moment? Because then I saw Abby's favourite driver,
Logan Sargeant.
Logan Sargeant, he binned it too.
Yeah.
Not quite though. He kept it out of the wall. Yeah, he was very dusty.
Exactly. So.
But he was actually doing all right. Like he was on a, he had something to prove after being told to sit out in Australia.
Yeah.
And hand his car over to Alex Albon. Mm. Yeah, I think he had something to prove. He was really carving up the field and then overcooked it underneath the bridge or the turn before the bridge. So disappointing.
Yes,
but. Yep. And James Vowles was not very happy about
he's the boss
all the
of
incidents.
Yeah.
He was not very happy. He's just looking at the financials like, oh, how are we going to pay for this?
As Gabe alluded to, there was no real surprises. Red Bull came home first and second, so that was Max and then Checo first and second. And then this, I guess, was a bit of a surprise because I think Ferrari enacted team orders. Is that right or not?
I don't think it wasn't team orders, it was more so a lack of team orders.
Right.
They were happy for Sainz to attack Leclerc.
And he had fresher tyres, so he passed Leclerc to come home in third. Aussie Oscar Piastri finished eighth. I got no.
That's about it. I mean, Christian Horner was very happy with Sergio Perez. He referred to that drive as being effectively Alonso-like with some of the moves he was pulling off, so... Mm. Be interesting to see what happens with that second seat at Red Bull going forward. And then we've got Shanghai up next time out.
Cool, in China. Nice. Okay, and it's been a while.
First time since 2019.
Yes, there you go. It's been a while. Okay, let's do the 77 report. Now, have you all seen the blue bodysuit suit that they've been advertising on that car riding service?
No.
It's a V8. It's a V8 Commodore ute. It's a 2012 model. It's got 254 horsepower, if you want to know. And apparently you can go and see the car tonight if you live in Melbourne. So 7 p.m. tonight, if you go to the car park, a Bunnings car park at Port Melbourne, the car will be there for everyone to watch. So, yeah, and for those wondering, Valtteri finished 14th in last weekend's Japanese GP. I've got nothing for the Phoenix this week, Roman Grosjean. But you wanted to tail off the motor rat with something, Maximilian?
Yeah, with a bit of IndyCar news anyway. It was announced that Prema will be joining IndyCar as a two-car operation starting next year.
How many cars have they got there at the moment?
Zero.
Oh, okay. Cool.
Yeah, so
they're the Formula 2 people.
Correct, and Formula 3. It's basically if you are wanting to get into Formula 1, ideally, you want to be placed at Prema because you statistically stand the best chance of actually winning the championships. And now they'll be entering into IndyCar because it sounded like, you know, F1 is sort of a closed shop at the moment, not really any new entrants in. So I think the idea is to provide a pathway for their talented drivers that otherwise, you know, if there were more seats in F1, might end up there. Instead, they have a pathway to IndyCar, which is still, yeah, a top flight of motorsport.
Did Prema try and get into Formula 1 at all? Or?
I think they may have, but I don't know if they made the first cut. I think it was Roden Motorsport were the other ones.
And Andretti.
Along with Andretti, yeah.
Okay, cool.
And then Roden got dropped out as well and by the FIA, and then FOM decided not to go ahead with Andretti.
Okay, we're going to hear from...
But at least now there's more seats for talented young drivers.
That's right. Cool. In IndyCar. You tune into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max, V, Izzy, Peter, Gabe. Mm-hmm. What do you got for us, V?
Okay, so I'm coming in today with a story about the first observed rainbow outside of our solar system.
Ooh.
So we all know how rainbows work, right? They're basically like visual phenomena that are caused by light radiation from a star, like sort of refracting and wobbling through a cloud of perfectly uniform droplets. And on Earth, those droplets are usually water, so you get rainbows from like clouds of evaporated water. But researchers have also observed an instance of this on Venus back in 2014 with its clouds of sulfuric acid. And there is a sort of generic name for this phenomena. Obviously, the word rainbow comes from rain on Earth. But in general, like, these are called glories. So you get, you know, glories on Venus and wherever else. Now, just last Friday, on the 5th of April, we've got a paper published in the journal Astronomy and Astrophysics by researchers out of the University of Geneva, QS ranking.
Mm.
Ooh.
Yeah, ooh, Geneva. I always think it's Genovia. I'm going to say it's 112.
Yeah, I'll go 8.
8?
Yeah.
Right.
86.
Okay. It's 128.
I was close.
You were pretty close, Peter. You were pretty close.
Oh, I'm so happy. Thank you to Princess Mia of Genovia.
But basically, these researchers described the first ever observation of a glory outside of our solar system on the exoplanet WASP-76b. And this planet is pretty crazy. It's got clouds of, like, vaporized iron. And the reason that iron can actually vaporize on this planet is because one side of the planet is always facing its host star. And, you know, it gets so hot there that the temperatures actually reach something like 2,000 degrees Celsius. And on this side of the planet, elements like iron melt and evaporate. And then those vapors condense on the other side of the planet, which is perpetually in night. And they kind of create clouds that drip molten iron rain. And basically, glories are really, really difficult to observe because they require very specific conditions. You need a bunch of things like stable atmospheric temperature, completely uniform spherical atmospheric particles, and you also need those particles, or droplets, to be directly illuminated by the star. And as the viewer, you also need to be in the right place at the right time. So on Earth, the viewer is you, but for other planets like Venus and WASP-76b, that's like super powerful telescopes. So yeah, extraterrestrial rainbows. Nice. I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah.
That is really cool.
Ready?
It's very cool.
We're ready.
Alien rainbows.
Yeah. They're out there.
Alien glory.
What happened to the X-37A?
Well.
We don't talk about that?
Asking the big questions.
Yeah, there's just a red dot on my head as I keep talking.
You're tuned to 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max, V, Izzy, Peter. What do you got for us, guy?
What I've got for you, Max, is another noise. Do you want to give it a listen?
Yes.
What do we reckon this is?
Mosquito.
Sounds like a bumblebee. Sounds like a fly.
Any other guesses?
Bee.
Yeah, it kind of sounds like a fly.
Any specific bee, Max? I gave a specific bee.
You did. A honey bee. How's that?
Yeah, okay. Funnily enough, these are the two exact types of bees we're looking at for this study. Honey bees and bumblebees.
No way. Was that a bumblebee?
We'll get there. 0420626733 is our text line if you want to give it a crack.
Mr. Star will just write in and say it's just a chicken on a bicycle ringing a bell, but you know.
I'll give you another one, okay? What we're going to hear now are two clips. One of them is going to be a honeybee. One of them is going to be a bumblebee. You ready?
Yes.
Yeah.
That's number one.
Mm-hmm.
And that's number two.
Yeah.
The first one's the bumblebee.
No, the first one's a honeybee because I felt it in my stomach.
Sure.
Is he? Any guesses?
I think the second one's the bumblebee.
Yeah,
it just felt like more intense.
Yeah, second one's a bumblebee.
Really?
Yeah.
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 So, can I explain my reasoning here?
Yeah.
The first one to me sounds like sitting on the deck at the batch in New Zealand to me, at my family's batch. We have loads of bumblebees there, and to me, it sounds like Kiwi summer. Mm. They're invasive, but it sounds like that to me.
Mm-hmm.
That's okay. My reasoning, more, that's but I don't know. Grounded. Maybe I'm wrong.
Mm. How about Gabe? Reality. You never tell us. You know.
Yeah. Maybe I won't. I'm just going to keep going.
I'm so annoying.
Because if you found that tough to tell apart,
yes.
That's kind of the point. Mm. Assistant Professor Laura Figueroa out of the University. No, no. Mm. Figueroa.
Okay.
I looked it up. Out of the University of Massachusetts in Amherst.
Stop it.
QS ranking of.
Oh.
245. She's an ecologist and an entomologist, which is just the best kind of person you can get.
Mm.
And even she says it's taken her a lot of her 10 plus years of fieldwork to be able to hear the difference between the buzz of a honeybee and the buzz of a bumblebee.
Mm.
But a lot of the world's hundreds of thousands of species of insects make noise. So there's noises to collect information out of. We humans just aren't quite good enough at making the most out of that information. But Max, what if AI could?
I imagine that.
There are a decent number of AI methods out there that are being developed to give entomology a new feature of its own. Assistant Professor Figueroa just led a team trying to figure out which ones actually hold up and which ones work best. What they found were AI models that could collectively match, I think, about 302 different species of insects so far. That's what they've found in the current models. Not all in the same model, I think, but, you know, totaled up. Those sounds ranged from the wing rubbing of grasshoppers to the buzzing of wing beats of bees to the sounds of pest weevils and borers moving stored grains.
Okay, sorry. I did think at first I thought you meant 320 differences in them the wings of them flying, and I was like, that's incredibly impressive. It's still impressive. It's not as impressive as
that is. It can tell the difference between the different types of buzzing between bees. But it can also tell the difference between the different types of wing rubbing between grasshoppers and the difference in grain storage. It can tell the difference in the bees.
Yeah, that's impressive. I just thought all 320 were just that.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
No, they're quite different. These types of AI approaches came across three different types of AI models. There was non-machine learning, machine learning, and deep learning. And that's the one where they found the most success. They found in some models of deep learning AI, their models could correctly classify hundreds of species of insects' noises with an accuracy rate of over 90%. Yeah, so if that can continue to get better and better at monitoring more and more insects, this could allow us to monitor the diversity and the number of different insect species out in the world. And with, you know, climate change, habitat loss, habitat fragmentation, pesticides, invasive species, everything else going on in the hidden world of insects, being able to know what's happening just by using some microphones and well-trained AI could be a pretty revolutionary breakthrough. Which means, if entomology tech works out, if you played AI this first noise, it could tell you that's a honeybee.
Oh!
And if you played this one, it could tell you it's a bumblebee. Two spotted bumblebee, to be precise, on the species. And that's what I got for you this week, Max.
You're tuning in to 4ZZZ. And the show is No Idea with me, Max, V, Izzy, Gabe, and Peter. And I've been mucking around with some software called Stable Audio. And now it can generate up to 3 minutes if you pay for it. You just feed it some sample music and then it will
You paid for it?
I did not pay for it, so it only allowed me 30 seconds. But I thought... This is
community radio, Peter. We didn't pay for any of
this.
My mistake. Apologies.
So I felt I should put our program coordinator's music into it. So for those unaware of Ian's band, it's called The Stress of Leisure or Leisure. And I put the sample music in of Girl on the Lilo. For those wondering what Girl on the Lilo sounds like, we'll just hit it off with this. So, yeah, so that's the Ian song, Stress of Leisure. And then I wrote some prompts saying, can you make it like Devo sounding? Can you make it like punk? Can you make it like Stress of Leisure if the AI knows what Stress of Leisure is?
I don't know what Stress of Leisure is.
Anyway,
I'm gonna be honest. What does that mean?
This is what it came back with. That's the name of the band. You ready? This is what it came back. This is the AI version of Girl on a Lilo. So there you go. That's just AI. Sounds just replicating it.
Very similar, bit of extra drums, yeah. Almost like it's being played from the garage next door.
Yeah. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, so it's a bit more bassy.
That's my AI report for this week.
That's great. And a great time to make fun of the programming coordinator too and have a crack.
Yeah.
We're up for show renewals again.
Yeah.
0, 1, 2.
And this is what they recovered using AI in the data set.
Thank God someone's working on this. I don't know what I'd do without it.
You tune into 4ZZZ, and the show is No Idea with me, Max, V, Izzy, Gabe, Peter. No Idea Space News. Boeing has delayed their spacecraft called Starliner. The launch will now happen in May. This will be a crew test mission and it'll fly to the ISS. And the problem is there's nowhere to dock the spacecraft at the moment. So once a port is free on the ISS, they'll be able to send up Starliner. And then if Starliner is successful and they come back alive, they'll be certified by NASA. And then NASA will have 3 launch providers to get astronauts to and from the International Space Station. Now we're going to talk about satellites. You've heard of CubeSats.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Now there's a new form factor being funded by Space Force. It's called DiskSat and will demonstrate sustained VLEO, or very low Earth orbit, flight and test a unique 1 meter diameter satellite.
That's big.
With a thickness of 2.5 centimeters. Mm. The disc-shaped satellite bus.
1 meter wide, 2.5 centimeter. Wow, yeah, disc. Very much a disc.
Yeah.
Brisby.
And it must be like a form factor, so they can... Yeah,
is that how they get it up
they
there?
They can probably send it's a like... whole lot.
Send me out, coach.
And this big Labrador just catches it in midair.
That's the landing strap.
Anyway, they just want to see if it's designed to increase on-orbit persistence, so less drag as it gets... And so it can travel very low to Earth's...
Maybe more fair to call this the record stage of satellites.
Yeah, the not compact quite discs.
The CDs,
LISS, or LISS, stands for Large In Space Server. It's set to launch in 2025. LISS will be the most powerful data server in orbit with 100 terabytes of data storage on board. It will be flown to the International Space Station and will be docked to an external platform on the Japanese Kibo module for 6 months of qualifying testing. The server includes Microchip Technology's Polar Fire field programmable gate array, a NVIDIA Jetson computer designed for artificial intelligence application, and a Phison X1 solid state drive.
Did you say Polar Fire?
Yeah, I said Polar Fire.
That is a sick name for a YA dystopian novel. Someone get that.
Correct.
Anyone listening who's an author, that's your next title. I've got it. Polar Fire. Come on, tell me you wouldn't read that.
By Matthew Riley.
Oh, yeah.
Dan Brown. Okay, LSST, which stands for Legacy Survey of Space and time, scientists have created a car-sized digital camera to understand the universe. The Legacy Survey of Space and Time, LSST, camera will help researchers address some big questions, including the nature of dark matter and our solar system, by photographing the southern sky. For how long you reckon they need to photograph the southern sky for? The year's 2024. They're going to launch it in 2024. Oh, start ramping it up now. 10 years.
They're going to 10.
They're going to take really?
Wow.
data for 10 years. It took the
going to be a good photo.
It took the Department of Energy's SLAC, or SLAC, National Accelerator Laboratory, over 20 years to build the largest digital camera ever created.
Yeah, now, well, they're SLAC.
Yeah. Hopefully no fingerprints on it.
They're going to go fast, are they?
some hairs. An LSST camera is complete and it has been thoroughly tested at SLAC. It will be packed up and shipped to Chile, and driven up the 2,700-metre high Cerro Pacon in the Andes, where it will be hoisted atop of a telescope observatory later this year. So yeah, it'll be ready by 2025, I guess, and we'll speak to it again in 2035 if we're still doing the show.
Yeah, it's been cancelled by then.
Yeah, I think it'll be cancelled this year. And that's it for the space news this week.
Everyone at the station knows which show's the most appreciated.
Uncancellable. It's obviously
this one. Uncancellable. That's what I love to say about us. Everything we do, everything we say, everything we've ever put online, uncancellable.
Yeah.
You tune into 4ZZZ. And the show is No Idea, but not for much longer. Sign us out, Gabe.
That is all we have time for this week on No Idea, Weekly Dose of Science. You can check out the show on 4ZZZ.org.au. The full recording's up there with all the music. If you want the condensed version on the go without the music, the podcast is available on your app of choice. Look up No Idea 4ZZZ. It's No with a K. No Idea. Thank you, Max. Thank you, V. Thank you, Izzy. Thank you, Peter, for your stories this week. Thanks for tuning in.
What else we got, Gabe? That it? And we'll speak to you next week.
Later.
Bye.
I'm a goddamn marvel of modern science.